Coming up on Boston Public Radio, Deval Patrick joins us in studio for a monthly Ask the Governor. He'll take our questions on late hours at the T, online gaming, trade missions, and latest at DCF. But most of the hour is devoted to your calls and comments.
Besides casinos and slot parlors, online gambling, as Jim said, that means in your pajamas on the couch may soon be here. We'll ask you, thumbs up or thumbs down? The Globe's Alex Beam on an outdoor church and a devastating peek into the retail world. Then we'll celebrate the 25th anniversary of the Internet. Has it changed your life completely? Tell us all up next on Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Hey, it's Tim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Hi there, Marjorie.
Hello, Jim.
Joining us, as he does once a month, to take our questions and yours, is the governor of the Commonwealth, Deval Patrick. Governor Patrick, it's good to see you.
What's up?
Excuse me? Now, if you have questions for the governor, my goodness.
I'm just trying to listen. This is my anecdote to hating winter. I have had enough of winter.
Is there an anecdote?
No.
Or was that it? Oh, you mean the was up,
no.
Was it?
Anecdote.
Antidote. Got it.
Anecdote.
You know what I vowed? I'm not going to complain once all summer long, no matter how hot and humid it gets. Because I'm. Don't you think that would be that's good?
You're not going to remember that, but
yeah,
it's
but
a nice
I like it hot and humid.
By the way, if you want to speak with the governor about the coming of spring or anything else, our number is 877-301-8897. You can email him at bpr@wgbh.org. Is that correct or is it news.org, ladies and gentlemen over there?
On the sign behind your head, it says WGBHnews.org.
Thank you, Governor.
And you can also see the governor correcting me on our live stream. This is at WGBHnews.org. Governor, it's good to see you.
It's great to see you and be seen.
Okay. So you just came from a big, I think you were there at this big press conference announcing the MBTA.
The late night service.
Yes. It's going to be starting March 28th.
That's correct.
What's the deal? What happened this morning?
So we were over in cold Kendall Square under a tent that seemed to be designed to protect your colleagues in the media and not those of us making the announcement. But we announced that that all tea service the subways and trolleys as well as buses will, or most bus lines, I should say, those that reach about 70% of the traveling public will run late night service beginning on March 28th on the weekends. And the other great news about this, and by the way, this is in response to students and restaurant goers and owners and workers and, you know, hospital workers and techies and so forth, who have said to us, a world-class city has a subway system that keeps the hours we do. And I'm glad we're able to do it, and we are able to do it in part because a number of private organizations and companies have stepped up to sponsor it. So we're going to try it out for a year. We're going to learn as we go, ask a lot of questions of riders and patrons and those whose employees or patrons depend on it so that we can refine the concept and go from there.
You're obviously convinced. Well, obviously, it's an experiment for a year, but I assume you're quite confident that the bad experience of 2005 won't be replicated. Why do you think this time it's going to be different?
You're talking about the night owl?
The night owl, the bus service, which obviously didn't cause there to be much ridership, and it got canned after a short period of time. Why are you more hopeful this time?
What Secretary Davey and Dr. Scott have said based on their study is that, one, it was buses and not the subway and trolley service, and that does make a difference. The second is we have different kinds of we have better technology now, so you can actually check on your app where the next bus or train is and how long it gets to you. And we're also trying to think the concept is to have waits in the 15-minute range rather than the half an hour, 45 minutes, as was the case in the past.
So March 28th is the kickoff
March
day.
28th.
One other thing, you were just mentioned before we went on the air about the women's event. We're going to talk about that in
just
a second.
Oh, that was great.
But just because it's in the news because I wrote a column about it, actually, and I felt so bad for a lot of these parents that I spoke with, the charter school issue. There's a bill up at the State House.
Did you write about that today?
I did. Okay. I wrote about it today. There's a bill up at the State House, as you know, which may or may not lift the cap on charters. It looks like it's not going to lift the cap on charters. I talked to State Rep Sonia Chang Diaz yesterday, and
Senator.
She's concerned. Senator, excuse me, and she's concerned about the reimbursement that the state is not reimbursing the schools the total amount when they take kids out of the public schools to go to the charter schools. But I just wanted to ask you, because you grew up in a tough school system, and you know, you talk to parents. There was a lottery yesterday at the City on the Hill Charter in Roxbury, and not a single parent showed up. And I was surprised, but I found out that the reason they don't show up anymore is because it's too upsetting. You know, they've filled out – one woman I spoke to had filled out 36 applications trying to get her kids into charter schools, and she's not been able to do it. And they don't come because they just get too bummed out. So this bill is hanging by a thread. For people that don't know, there's this year there's 13,600 applications for 2,200 slots.
In Boston.
In Boston, that's correct. And, you know, you could, you're the governor. I mean, you could really push
but
hard.
Not the king, so
you're
be
not,
careful.
You're not the king. But what do you think, how do you react to that?
That's, well,
you know what these people are talking about, their struggle.
I do know what they're talking about. You know, and as the only governor in 30 years who's raised the charter cap, I'm a supporter of charter schools. I don't, as you know, think they are the you know, the sole solution to all that that ails us. And I think that the more innovation and flexibility we're seeing in the district schools, the better results those district schools are getting. Orchard Gardens is just one example of – and just one example, but one frequently cited. I think there's going to be a good bill. I think there's more than there's a lot of negotiating in order to get to any piece of complex legislation, and the funding issue is real, Marjorie. That's not particularly as the number of charter schools grow. So having a conversation and really trying to wrestle through the funding question has to be, or I think it is reasonable for that to be a part of this this debate. And I think they may yet get there. There is a way to do this which is attractive to me. I'm not going to get to make the call. But it is attractive to me, and I've expressed that. And it has to do with the differences between where we are against caps in Boston, for example, and where we are in other communities. You know, we are not up against the charter cap in many places in the Commonwealth, and we have caps that are specific to school districts. And so when people talk about raising the caps, they're mostly talking about Boston.
Right.
Or they're talking about one or two other urban centers.
Correct.
And it would be possible to think about giving the commissioner or the Board of Primary Secondary Education the authority to move charter authority around from community to community. So if there was not the demand in community X, but there was in Boston, you could authorize that charter in Boston and still stay within the statewide cap. That's one way, it seems to me, to have the kind of flexibility I think that you were talking about in your column.
One question, Governor. You said to Marjorie a second ago, I think you said you were confident that it would be a bill. From what I've read, that Sonia Chang Diaz has till the 19th, 6 days from now, to report something out of under whatever the legislative rules are. Are you convinced there will be something reported out of her committee?
You are right to call me on this. I am hopeful there will be a bill. I am not confident there will be a bill, but I think that there are a lot of good people, both the advocates from outside and folks who are working on it in the legislature, including Senator Chang Diaz, who want a good bill.
Last thing before we get to the calls, the number is 877-301-8970. We promise you 1 minute and then the governor is yours. We were speaking to Brian McGrory yesterday from obviously the Globe editor about your women's leadership initiative. And I know you know this, but for those who don't know, we have in one of the most progressive states in America, probably, I think you might know better, the single worst record of electing women to constitutional office in Congress anywhere in the country. It's not worlds better in the corporate world. You attempted with a million-dollar grant the other day to at least begin the ball rolling in a more positive direction. Give us the short version of what you're doing and what the goal is here, Governor.
Well, there are two things. One, maybe three. It came out of taking a look back at the level of the numbers of senior women who lead this administration, and we are at, I think, over 51% at the manager level and about 46-47% at the senior
in your administration.
In our administration, uh-huh. And they are amazing professionals and extraordinary contributors. And a couple of folks on the staff said, you know, we tend not to be very good at the bragging part of the job because we're always thinking about the next thing. So how do we do? How do we take? How do we acknowledge that achievement, and at the same time reach for what's next? Because the fact is that the results in the private sector are not as good, and the things that we and that we should be conscious of the things we can do better to make the workplace more successful for aspiring women in state government. So we did two things yesterday. We announced a task force of both government. Private sector, not-for-profit professionals, men and women, to really think about and look at our existing policies and practices to make sure that the workplace is a welcoming place and a successful place for capable women, to take best practices from other governments as well as private employers and give me a set of actionable recommendations that we can implement either before I go or that I can hand over to my successor. And we also launched a fellowship program where we can bring in women at the graduate student level for a year or so of management experience to give them a chance to try it out. And that's, you know, the point is all of us who've had our opportunities have had the chance to try things out, to be mentored and coached as we went along to see where our strengths and weaknesses lie, and we want to be intentional about that with women. I have to tell you that the event itself, Jim, was electric. The room was full of and to standing room of appointees in the administration on the bench. Really, really amazing collection of talent and a lot of enthusiasm.
Why do you think, last thing on this, then we will go to the calls. Why do you think it has taken Massachusetts in so much of its public and private existence so long to catch up to equity in terms of women in leadership?
I'm talking about
both corporate and electoral.
I'm sorry, I thought you were talking
about
electoral.
Both.
Well, you started, I should emphasize that the initiative is not about elected
office seekers. I understand
that.
I'm sorry. Yes, I understand that.
In terms of elections, I mean, I'm thrilled that Elizabeth Warren is representing us in the Congress. There are a number of really strong women running for governor right now, or for other statewide offices, and that's a good thing. I think that probably this is an area where you want to make sure that you've got a pool of talent, and then you want to let people make their judgments on the strength of the on the strength of the merits. And I think in the private sector, you know, it's interesting. I step back and reflect on your question from the perspective of race, which has been another challenge over time in the private sector, in C-suites, executive suites, mm-hmm. and in boardrooms. It's fascinating to me how many companies tend to go to the same people for their board seats. So you see, you know, friends of mine who are African American who are on multiple boards, and newcomers who are not on boards yet have trouble breaking in. And I think we've got to be intentional about opening up in the case of women that talent pool and making it known to people. I said to one person yesterday, they ought to take that attendee list from the event yesterday and hand it out to every CEO and every chair of a corporate board in New England, because there's your talent pool right there.
Fair enough. Let's get to the calls. He is Governor Deval Patrick. He's with us till 1 o'clock at 877-301-8970. Governor.
April is calling from Cohasset. April, are you there?
Hi, April.
Hi. It is an honor to speak with you.
Thank you.
I'm calling because I'm really stuck here. I've been dealing with unemployment for about 4 years now, since 2010, mm-hmm. and I've been calling, and they said that my case is in appeals, and to not worry because I've been getting all these bills. And, of course, every bill has interest put on it, and, you know, for years of interest, it's accumulated quite a lot.
April, you're getting bills for what? I'm sorry.
For unemployment, because they had given me unemployment, and then they decided, we gave it to you. We shouldn't have given it to you.
Okay. So they're trying to recover unemployment payments paid you're now told are not eligible for.
Right.
Okay.
I disagree with their decision, mm-hmm. and so right now I'm writing to the Board of Review, mm-hmm. and because I spoke to them March 8th, 2014, and they said, I don't know why they've been telling you your case was in appeals. It looks like some of them are dismissed, others are unknown, mm-hmm. But I never got anything from the Board of Review. So they said they would, if I requested it, they would send out letters saying what the decisions were.
Okay.
However, they said the only thing I could do now is go to district court, mm-hmm. and I'm not sure what I'm supposed to. My question really is what do I do at district court?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how to do this, and it's just.
I'm sorry, April. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I don't know what the answer is to your question, but I will get it. If you want to hang on a second, I'll get your phone number and I'll have somebody follow up this afternoon.
April, don't hang up. One of our producers will get your number and give it to the governor's office. April, thank you for the call and good luck. Governor.
Let's see. Rick is calling from Chelsea. Rick?
Hi, Rick.
Hey, how's it going?
How are you?
Good. I had a question about the Tobin Bridge. Mm-hmm. Been living up on property in Chelsea like years ago. I'm wondering why there's no bike lane or pedestrian lane on the Tobin, so close to the city.
Yeah.
Like, what, an hour with public transportation, or like bus, boat shuttle, something.
Are you biking at this minute?
No, getting into the truck. I'm a dog walker.
Oh, okay. Because it sounds like
breathless.
Your cell service is breaking up a little bit. I wondered if you were breathless. I don't know why there's no bike lane on the Tobin Bridge. We're going to do some work on the Tobin Bridge. Actually, it's underway right now to remove the toll booths and have open road tolling up there in the next few months. It's a good time to ask the question, and I'm happy to. If you want me to come back to you with the answer I learn, hang on, and we'll get a number.
Rick, you do the same thing. Just to stay on hold. Our producers will get the number from you as well, Governor.
Great. Steve is calling from Milford. Steve, you there?
Governor, thank you.
Whoops.
It's a bad phone day. We lost Steve. That was not us. Let's just be clear. Our number is 877-301-8970. Steve, please call back. Governor, before we take another call, you're the person appointed head of the Gaming Commission who was picked. He and his colleagues have picked one slots parlor. They're about to pick as many as three casinos in the next few months. Is quoted in the Herald yesterday as saying, "The time is now. It's upon us. We can't wait any longer, even though we're still in the middle of casino licensing. This is about online gaming." How do you feel about yet the next step?
God, really?
Yeah, really.
First of all, you should probably ask the chairman, but my understanding is that the point he was making is the exact opposite of jumping with both feet into online gaming right now. But I'll leave that to him. That's my understanding from him. You know, it feels to me like we are being very careful and very deliberate, appropriately so, about stepping deeper into gaming. And for all the complaints the commission has sometimes had to deal with, I think they have been appropriately careful about how they've done that. And I'd say do one thing at a time. Because this is a big experiment for us, right? I think the public is still with us, but it's got to be done. It's got to be done right. So,
just to be clear, your understanding of Steve Crosby meant the opposite of what the word suggests.
That is my understanding, but you should ask him.
Okay,
that,
we will. Fair enough. Let's try the phones again, Governor.
Let's see. Did we get Rick back?
No, he's not back. It's very sad, but okay. We'll give him a chance in a few minutes.
So John is calling from Quincy. John, you there?
Hi, John.
John from Gardner.
Hi, John.
We have two Johns. John from Gardner. Hold on a couple of minutes. John from Quincy, you are next. Hi, John from Quincy.
Hi, Governor. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Your administration is increasing fees with the registry. I'm just trying to see what's the reasoning behind that.
When we, John, just for those who may not know what we're talking about, but everybody knows this, right?
There was a vote yesterday. People are big on that.
Yeah, there was a vote yesterday at the MassDOT board to raise fees at the registry. And John, the reason we're doing that is because last year that we did the transportation.
I don't know. I thought it was 2 years ago.
Might have been two years ago. But when we had the revenue issues, we were trying to raise money for transportation and for education. I think it was last year. I hate the winter. what we got from the legislature was a couple.
It was last year. You're right. Of course, it was.
It was a couple of different tools to raise money for transportation, and one was to increase fees and tolls, and to do it periodically. In the case of most of the RMV fees, they have not gone up in a long, long time. Nobody likes it. I mean, I don't like it, but it is it is meant to help us meet the costs of the transportation system that people say they want, and it's not going to be enough, but it's a contribution.
John from Quincy, thank you so much for the call.
You know, one quick thing I wanted to interject here because no one's asking about it, so I will, although we in the media have been accused of focusing too much on this. This whole brouhaha about the St. Patrick's Day Parade in South Boston, Mass Equality.
Is that coming up?
Sunday.
Yes. Are you going to sing this year?
Oh, God.
The governor has sung in past years at the breakfast.
Yes.
Correct?
So that has happened. That has happened.
Okay.
You know what?
What?
I have to tell you that that the Speaker and the Senate President and I should speak for myself, but I think it's also true of them. Dread the breakfast. It is, you know, it's fun. It's often witty, but until you sit down again after you've done your thing, it is a miserable experience. Absolutely miserable experience. That you know, you kind of go in half knowing you're gonna bomb. Fortunately for me, this will be my I think ninth one.
Because you were a candidate?
I went once as a candidate. And as a candidate, you have to stand. You know, you have to stand off to the to the wings. And I think I was the last one on the first time I went.
But last year you made up an excuse as to why you couldn't be there, so you sent in a video. Do you remember that?
I didn't make up an excuse. I had a reason.
Although, sorry.
He had a doctor's appointment on a Sunday. He got his teeth drilled.
I feel like I'm coming down with something right now.
It is tough. I mean, careers can be made and broken at the breakfast, which I've covered a few times. It can be a long 3 or 4 hours. Jim's going to cover the entire thing from beginning to end. He's become legendary as the host extraordinaire of the breakfast.
Thanks.
But anyway, as people know, and you certainly do, Mass Equality, represents gay, lesbian groups, is given up. They're not going to try to march in the parade. Mm-hmm. They're going to be in the back of the parade, a mile back in the parade, along with the Veterans for Peace and some other groups, Tina Cherry, actually, from who's
Lewis
done a lot
Brown
of great
peace
work in Dorchester. She's going to be in that parade and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I just wonder what you make of this parade. To me, it's sort of it's become an embarrassment for mm-hmm. Boston that a million people are going to show up for a discriminatory parade, which is basically what it's become. Mm. Even though they have the right under the Supreme Court decision to bar whoever they want to from the parade, it's no gay, no Veterans for Peace parade.
Well, you know, I'm disappointed too. I like the people who organize the parade, and I have tremendous respect and I try to support the folks who've been excluded for the parade because of the very good work that they. That they do. Things change slowly. You know, I think the public is probably where you are in terms of the interest in an inclusive parade. You know, it's day will come. And we have, fortunately, a strong and well-earned and deserved reputation as a Commonwealth for being an open place. And I don't think that the parade blots out that reputation.
Let's take another call before we take a brief break. He is Governor Deval Patrick. He's at 877-301-8970 with you till 1 o'clock. Governor.
Bob is calling from Webster. Bob, are you there?
Hello, yes.
Hi, Bob.
You there?
Thanks. Taking my call.
Thanks for holding on.
I'll try to be brief. My wife and I pay more than 50% of our adjusted gross income to health care insurance premiums alone.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're very excited about the new Affordable Care Health Act. And we're trying to sign up online through the Health Connector.
Mm-hmm.
And as we did that, we ran into a spot where it said, we can't verify you online.
Mm-hmm.
You need to call the help number. We called the help number. And my call to you is about the training of the people who are on these lines and what information they actually know and don't know.
Mm-hmm.
We were told we had to drive to Boston with our driver's license and show them our driver's license. This is the only way we could apply for assistance.
Oh, gracious.
Also,
From Webster?
From Webster.
Mm-hmm.
Also, they said the only once you signed up for a plan, you could not change it. It would take 6 to 8 weeks to get a reply as to whether you were granted assistance. Well, our deadline is April 1st, so 6 to 8 weeks would put us beyond April 1st. And they said, well, then you really can't go for assistance because you'll be beyond your deadline. If you're not granted assistance, you'll miss the plan and you'll be uninsured. We drove to Worcester and spoke to a very nice woman there,
mm-hmm.
who said, no, that's not true. I can sign you up online here for the assistance program. Just show me your license. She did it in Worcester.
Mm-hmm.
And she also said that sign up for whatever plan you want now, and if you're granted assistance, that's considered a change of your status, and you can then change your plan because of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so my comment is that the people on the Health Connector phone
line, you're getting
line,
two different instructions
about something that's fairly important to our life.
Sure.
And so you don't really know who to believe.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, I was asking for a phone number to get to the Worcester office, and they said they gave me a phone number, which actually turned out to be the mayor's office in Boston. So there's all this misinformation going around, and I was just hoping that some way people would be able to be better trained about something that's this important to a lot of us out here in the field.
So, Bob, first of all, let me ask you, are you in the so-called AA coverage? Are you in the temporary coverage so your health insurance won't lapse as of the end of the month?
No, we are not in any temporary coverage at this point. I don't even know what that is.
Okay.
We are going to sign up for the plan, the full rate plan,
right,
for us, which is over $800 a month each, $1,600 a month, because mm-hmm. we have no other option at this point. We haven't been contacted as far as the assistance program or anything else at this point.
Okay. So first thing I want to say is when we finish staying on the line, and I'll make sure that that your situation is dealt with. But on the broader question about the service you've gotten on the Connector phone line, first of all, I apologize for it. We've been adding people at a pretty good clip, hundreds of new people to come on, frankly, to help deal with the ways in which the website has failed us. And if you're not getting good information from the people on the phone, then the very reason they're there for is not being served, and I will look to that. I understand that Optum, which is the expert we brought in that helped fix the federal website, and is supplying us with the people, has a pretty rigorous training, but not by your description, to be sure. So I will look into that.
Bob, do
but,
not
but
go
hang
away.
On, hang on. Yeah, please. And we'll get your contact information and take it from there.
Thank you, Bob. Before we take a quick break, the Globe reported this morning early that the House is reporting out a minimum wage bill, House in Massachusetts, $10.50 an hour with reform to the unemployment insurance system. As you know, the Senate voted on an $11 hike. Are you going to get in the middle of that House and Senate? I know the minimum wage matters a lot to you,
yeah,
and your friend, the president. Are you going to get in the middle of this, dispute, for lack of a better expression, between the House and the Senate?
I don't think it's fair to call it a
difference
dispute.
Of opinion.
Well, you know, this is the process, right? And you bet your life I'm going to get in the middle of it. I'm supporting enthusiastically an increase in the minimum wage. I am also supporting enthusiastically some updating of our unemployment insurance system. I think it's not a bad thing at all that we're doing them at the same time. And I think it is natural and customary for the Senate to be in one place and the House to be in the other, and to work out those differences. You know, the Senate took some action. I want to say a couple months ago, maybe 6 weeks ago, and the House is going to take some action today, and that then sets up the opportunity for them to work it out. And I'm going to do what I can to help them get to.
You're going to fight for the higher number for the $11?
Well, you know what? I have on purpose, Jim, stayed away from embracing one number because I think it is easier to help broker the range. I mean, if the House really does come in at 1050, there's not that much difference between the two. Between the two numbers, some of the concerns from the business community will be the speed with which it's implemented. You know, what's the phase-in period so that they can deal with it, and there are going to be issues. I am almost certain about how to get in the same place on unemployment insurance reform. But this is a really positive step forward on both of these fronts, and I'm glad for it.
Fair enough. He's Governor Deval Patrick. Very brief break, about 60 seconds, and then more of the governor and you till 1 o'clock right here on WGBH Radio. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan, and our sidekick. Well, he's not our sidekick. Our guest. I'm sorry. I don't know what I was thinking there for a minute. You want to be in radio something. You're looking for work, right?
I am looking for work. Well, what's the pay like?
It's not real good, but the satisfaction is huge.
Is that
trust
right?
me, it
well,
is. Yeah.
I think it's pretty good, actually.
Yeah,
we can't complain.
In any case, Governor Deval Patrick is here, as he is every single month for an hour. Ask the governor to take your questions. Governor, let's go back to the phones.
I think Steve is back from Milford. Steve?
Hi, Steve.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie.
Hi, Steve.
My wife, who listens to Jim and Marjorie every day,
thank you.
Unfortunately, one of the thousands of Massachusetts residents that suffers from a very devastating case of disseminated Lyme disease and other tick-borne co-infections.
Mm-hmm.
So, first, Governor, I want to thank you and your administration for all the awareness you're bringing to Lyme disease and other tick-borne co-infections. May is Lyme Disease Awareness Month, and you appointed a task force to raise awareness, et cetera, and thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
And second, I wanted to bring your attention to a bill that's in the Massachusetts legislature right now. It's H-989, and if passed, it's a bill that would require insurance companies to pay for the treatment of Lyme disease.
Do they not
right now? They will only cover the first 28 days of treatment. But for many, many people, like my wife, if it gets beyond a certain point, then treatment can last for years.
Wow.
You are out of pocket 100%, and you can be spending thousands or tens of thousands of dollars.
And this is the antibiotic the regimen of intense antibiotics you get at the—
Yes, yes, including IV antibiotic treatment in many cases because it can become neurological and disseminated through every system in your body. The bill had its first hearing in the House Financial Services Committee back in the autumn.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's in, I think, an organization called CHIA, I believe. They have to analyze the financial impact of the bill.
Yeah, this is the entity that came out of the cost containment bill, yes.
Okay. Well, it seems to just be stuck there. So those of us who have family members and our patients ourselves are really desperately looking for some momentum on this bill. So if there's anything you can do to just persuade CHIA and the legislature to move this forward so that there can be some financial relief to those of us who are dealing with this.
So, Steve, I will check on it at CHIA. CHIA is independent. And they're supposed to do their analysis without involvement from me or people like me. I'll check and see what the status is and try to get a sense of when it may come out. And I will get informed about it as well.
Steve, thank you for the call and good luck to your wife.
Yes.
We appreciate it. Governor, let's go back to the phones.
Let's see. Lisa is calling from Cambridge. You there, Lisa?
Hi, Lisa.
Hi. Hi. I was calling about the access path that goes between the North Cambridge neighborhood and the back entrance to Alewife T Station.
Under Route 2?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. It's actually, the path is actually on our side.
Okay.
Route 2. It's between the playing field and the station entrance.
Okay, yep.
It really floods all the time. It's there's a huge dip in the path.
Uh-huh.
Water collects, and it's gotten bigger and bigger. And, you know, when you go through it, people are sort of mincing along the mud.
Oof.
They stay out of, like, what's become now like a foot of water.
Wow.
And it's also an access path for a whole neighborhood and also all the public housing that's on Ringe,
mm-hmm.
which also has a lot of disabled people living there. So
mm-hmm.
it's forcing people to go out to cross at Route 16, which is a pretty dangerous road. Somebody got killed there recently.
Hmm.
And the reports that I'm seeing in our neighborhood emails suggest that somebody is saying it's going to cost like $300,000 to fill this dip, and I wonder why we can't just fill it and crown it so the water flows off instead of collecting like a swimming pool.
Is there drainage in the tunnel?
It's not under the tunnel.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The tunnel sort of sits right under Route 2, which sits between the main station and this particular entrance, which
okay.
is at the inbound side of the platform.
Okay.
There is a water area, and I guess they're saying, oh, well, this is a wetlands situation, and I guess the land is owned by W.R. Grace, but, you know, if it's owned by W.R. Grace, it's probably not, you know, a pristine land that...
Hmm. Well, I'm sorry.
Like this. Sorry.
Yeah. No, go ahead.
No, that's pretty much all I had to say. It's just been a long time, and we don't seem to be able to get anywhere with it.
Is it all the time, or is it when it rains or there's thaw
wet.
Like this?
Yeah, when it's wet.
Yeah. Let me find out about it. If you want to hang on, we'll get a number. I'll ask the folks at the T to check on it for you and for me, and they can come back to you with whatever their plan is.
That's an email, so there's more information in that email.
Did you send the email here to the station?
I did.
Okay.
Oh, they'll forward it to the governor's okay. office, Lisa. So stay on hold, and they'll check for it. And thank you kindly for
great.
The call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Governor, the Herald is reporting this morning that this Child Welfare League out of D.C., this watchdog group that's looking into the Department of Children and Families,
yep.
is supposed to have come out with some preliminary findings today. Do you have any heads up on what they're going to say?
Yeah, I've been briefed on it. So this is the national agency we asked to come in and,
yes.
and give a look at whether the policies we have are the policies we need. And they aren't done, and they won't be probably until May. But at the time they were appointed, I said – publicly, I asked them to tell us your progress about halfway through, and we would tell the public. And that's what this progress report is. I don't think there are any surprises. I mean, they make the point about that I and others have made about the importance of increasing the staffing, so we have more social workers to do the work, and we're making some progress there. And the legislature is moving through the supplemental budget to give us the funding to do that, and we may actually get that supplemental budget out of the legislature today, which is really good news. Technology was another thing that they raised, so that the people who are making these decisions have up-to-the-minute information, which has been a really serious problem for a long time. They talk about there was a story about the teen runaways. Do you remember that?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because I know you've defended Olga Roche. She's the head of the DCF, and I've interviewed her. And she's a really lovely person. But I think there was kind of a crisis in confidence beyond the original crisis in confidence when she testified up in Beacon Hill, and she was asked if she could say whether every one of the 36,000 children was healthy and cared for. And
you know, the reason you're smiling is because nobody could say yes to that,
she did say yes to it. And then we found out that hundreds of kids were missing. So it does undermine confidence.
So can I just say two things? First
sure.
of all, I, my understanding is that she was answering a question about the 0 to 6, the kids who were in that in the group that
Jeremiah Oliver
was from. And she's spoken with the chairman about that. And my understanding is they understand each other. But can I also just want to take sort of friendly objection to the kids being, the runaways being missing. In fact, they're mostly not missing. They know at DCF when a child is running. Remember, they're not in lockdown.
Right.
These are not kids who are placed in confinement. They're placed in foster homes, and sometimes teenagers run away. In fact, not too long after that, I think the story that was the individual who was reported on in your paper's story was processed the way it normally that those situations are processed, and was found and returned to the home within a couple of days. I heard one story about a kid, social worker. Talked about one of the kids who was a teen runaway and who had called the social worker and said, look, I need a break from the foster home for a while. I'm fine. I'm not going to tell you where I am, but I need a break, and I'm going to come back in a couple of days. I mean, these are not ideal situations, but remember, and you know, to your point and others, I acknowledge the anxiety we all have when a child welfare agency doesn't have track of a given child. I totally get that, but I think the point to remember here is that so many of the issues we have come down to the and I think the Child Welfare League is telling us this in their progress review so far, come down to having enough people, enough professionals to do the assignment that they have. And enough and the right and the timeliness of information to do that assignment, and those are things we are working on. And on Commissioner Roche, look, if I thought it served the best interests of children to change out the leadership at DCF, I'd do it in a heartbeat. But I'm not convinced that it does, and I think that the stability of the agency with all this incoming right now is actually pretty important to the safety of the children, at least until we get through the review of the policies and we see what we must do to update those policies and those practices.
Okay,
let's go back to the calls. Governor,
let's see. Ed is calling from Georgetown. Ed, you there?
Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I know you're having some changes this year with the housing authorities. And I want to give you an incident that happened. I won't tell you where unless you want it off the phone,
okay,
off the air.
Okay.
We had an incident with – we had a woman here that was on the board. She still lives here, but she was probably about 80 years old. And they had an incident. She and one of the other women went into the office that had to talk about her checks procedure.
Mm-hmm.
They had kind of an argument. And this director pushed and slapped this woman who was almost 80 years old.
Good grief.
And she was never, ever reprimanded.
Wow.
And we couldn't do anything about it because she had control of the board, and she had them wrapped around her little finger, and it was a bad incident. I fought like a son of a gun, and I tried to get rid of her. The police were called.
Wow.
They wrote her up.
Yeah.
And the police chief came in and said, non-incident, and because she's got a lot of people wrapped around her fingers, and it's a sin, but she gets away with everything.
Did the...
I know there's other things happening with other authorities, so I know there's got to be some changes. I'm glad you're doing that.
I'm trying.
But I'm...
Was it a resident who was pushed and slapped, the 80-year-old you talked about?
Yeah, she's a resident, but she was also a member of the housing authority.
Did she file charges?
Well, the funny part of it is this director knew she screwed up, so she turned around and hired a lawyer and sued her for abuse.
Please call me at the Boston Herald and leave your number, and we could have somebody look into this. I'm sure you want the number for the governor, but
and Ed, you want to give me that offline rather than
and Miss Eager might want to call me. I can give her a little bit of extra information.
Yeah,
leave
the number and I will call you. Thank you very much.
Thanks,
hey, Ed. Thank you. Don't go away.
Yeah, hang on, please.
Now, Governor, if I can just for a second, I know you've been. I've been told by people close to you, you're very frustrated that no one has asked you the following question. So I'm going to get into the breach. Can you? I don't know how to put this. Can you imagine a situation at some undefined point in the future? under certain as yet undefined circumstances when you, I don't know, when you might seek higher office? I know you haven't been asked that question, but I'm posing it to you now. Can you address that directly, please?
I have no plan, Jim.
Fine, okay, fine.
I have no plan to make a plan.
Okay, fine. The only reason I ask that is because Marjorie is dying to ask you a question. She's been talking about for a week since a picture in the Herald. Go ahead, Marjorie.
I am. You know, I saw you coming down the plane with the steps of Air Force One with the President of the United States. I believe you had a camel hair coat on and a quite an impressive red scarf or whatever. I am dying
blue,
to know.
Given to me
was
by
it blue?
My wife.
I am sorry. I thought it was red. So I'm dying to know. What is the swankest thing? If you're going to tell somebody I was on Air Force One and this is the most impressive thing, is there one or two things you can tell me?
So it was very cool.
Yeah.
I was telling Jim this story before you came in the studio.
I was fixing my hair.
But you look marvelous.
Thank you.
By the way, so we had been at this event in Hartford to support the minimum wage, and all of my colleagues from the region, or most of them, had come down to express our support as well. And then the president had business here afterwards, so I was invited to fly from Hartford to Boston with him, and. We get on the plane, and of course it starts to move as soon as he's on board, right? And I don't know where I'm supposed to go, you know, what I'm supposed to do, but so I'm directed into his little office.
It's like a living room kind of deal, right?
Well,
you're not
there,
sitting in a regular
seat. It's a series of living rooms, but his space is special. So I'm sitting there with him, and he says, welcome aboard Air Force One. And I said, well, thank you, Mr. President. He said, have you ever been on Air Force One before? And I said, well, no, not in your administration, because, in fact, in the Clinton administration, I had an opportunity to fly with the president.
Didn't know that.
As well. And he said, well, welcome aboard. And I said, Mr. President, well, thank you. I said, but really? He said, what do you mean? I said, Hartford to Boston? Really? That's all you got? And he started to laugh, and he said, well, we could go by way of Tokyo if you want. And I said, we don't have time for that, but maybe by way of Chicago or something like that. I mean, it's a 15-minute flight.
That's a good point.
Anyway, it was great.
You didn't give any detail. Are there like
It's classified.
I mean, are there the glasses, or maybe the bathroom is really special?
There was no time to go to the bathroom or have a drink for that matter.
It
was
hot tubs.
I don't
know. Brass, faucets.
There's a lot there are a lot of napkins and things like that say welcome aboard.
High
end
liquor.
I didn't. There wasn't time for that either.
Gosh.
Hey, Governor,
I'm disappointed.
One last.
I mean, 15 minutes might be enough for you.
That's right. I'll have a quick one.
Fill her pockets, Governor. Before we leave this topic, though, on a serious note,
I got some
note.
Hershey's Kisses.
Oh, that's pretty.
With
good.
A presidential seal.
Yeah, so no, presidential seal.
So you didn't get any food either.
No, there was no time.
No
is
time.
What I'm saying.
No time. Yikes. Okay. All right, Jim.
Governor,
before
we leave this, on talk shows of late, when they talk about successors, you know, is Hillary Clinton running, not running? Your name has been brought up, and don't worry, I'm not going to ask you the same old tired question, at least not this month. If Hillary doesn't run, who does? If Hillary does run, who's a vice president? Your name comes up in that category. Virtually every time I have heard your name mentioned as a potential presidential candidate sometime in the future, almost without exception, somebody, and not some reactionary redneck, says, well, let's face it, there aren't going to be two black guys in a row in the corner office. When you hear that, and I'm sure you have or have read it, and what's the reaction you have?
Well, I think to myself, nobody says, you know, we can't have two white guys in a row.
And that's it?
What else?
You know? Well, there's got to be more. There's a piece of you that puts right over the edge.
I mean, there's,
it?
There's look. I'd probably have more to say about it if I were actually running. I think it says something about the progress we've made and the novelty of it. I think there's always room and always appetite for visionary leadership and for competence in whatever package it comes in.
Fair enough. Let's go back to the calls. He's Governor Deval Patrick.
Let's see. John is calling from Boston. John, you there?
Hi, John.
Yes, I am here. And first of all, let me say that I think it's a great privilege for me to be able to speak with you, and I thank you for your time,
you
certainly.
Bet.
I am calling.
I feel there's a butt coming.
Yes, well, I guess we all come with some issues on our minds, so.
Sure.
I am not dissimilar from that.
Sure.
I am calling because I just wanted to get your thoughts about Bridgewater State Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm not mistaken, I believe that you have spoken fairly recently about the unfortunate death of a mentally ill young man there back in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
And while Bridgewater State certainly is a psychiatric hospital, it has the feel and the culture of a correctional facility.
Mm-hmm.
And that's different from a hospital. And so I just wondered what your thoughts were about this, given the fact that I just simply find myself concerned sometimes about the patients there.
Yeah, yeah. And I appreciate your question, and I share some of those concerns. I think the case you're referring to is the Messier.
Joshua
Messier. Case where I hate to call him an inmate because he wasn't actually he wasn't criminally confined.
He had mental illness.
He had mental illness issues, and in the course of the use of restraints, he died. And I think that the there's a civil case right now that the Attorney General is involved in around the culpability of guards and others in that death. I'm really troubled by what I understand to have been the circumstances. It feels to me like there is probably at least some negligence there. I shouldn't say at least, that there is some negligence there. What we did investigate very thoroughly with the help of the with the leadership of Secretary Cabral is how that incident was documented and followed up on, because there are a whole series of procedures that are supposed to be followed and were not. And as a result of that, there was some disciplinary action taken. I'll also say that I think that the use of the so-called four-point restraints, I mean, sometimes the restraints were used to restrain pregnant mothers while giving birth.
Oh, that was awful.
That's over now. As a result of emergency regulations we put in place, we're looking at a more limited. You want to impose these limitations on the use of restraints consistent with the safety of the corrections officers and other staff and other of those who were detained. But I think we can do a better job, and we're trying to get down that path now.
One last thing about this. I know you initiated some disciplinary procedures and those sort of things. My recollection was in post this 2009 incident that the medical examiner in the case said that it was a homicide. There was
right.
no prosecution by, I think his name is Cruz, the district attorney there.
Mm-hmm.
Are you in, I don't even know if it's appropriate. Are you involved in any discussions, whether it's with Cruz's office, Martha Coakley's office, about whether or not, in light of the Globe story by Mike Resendez, the action taken by
who
your
did
office,
some amazing reporting, Ben.
Resendez,
yeah.
Yes, we agree.
Yeah.
Are you involved in any discussions, or have you heard anything about whether or not any criminal prosecutions actually will happen in this case?
No, I think I haven't been in touch with their offices. To your question, I've read that the DA has decided not to prosecute it. And by the way, that's not – I mean, without knowing all of his or his staff's analysis, homicide doesn't necessarily mean it's intentional. It can also be – a homicide simply means a person died at the mm-hmm. hands of another. And I do think, by the way, the supposition that a homicide implies intentionality – had something to do with why some of the procedures at DOC were not followed in the wake of the death.
Governor, before you go,
yes,
we only have a minute left. You are going out of the country to Panama. Is it Panama, Mexico?
Panama and Mexico.
What's it? You've been doing these trade trips, for lack of a better.
That's not the reason. Thank you very much.
It's a nice sidelight.
Are you content that the other day, by the way, someone who is ordinarily incredibly critical of everything you do praised you when this Dubai to Boston Emirates flight thing says this wouldn't have happened. This is a commentator, wouldn't have happened without the governor's involvement in these trade missions and that sort of thing. What real benefit have we seen from a number of the
missions?
Trips you've made? Yeah, we only have a minute because
I know
you've got to go
you,
too.
Since time is limited, I'll give you just one example. There was an independent study done, I think, last year on the benefits to Massachusetts of the trade mission we did to Israel 2.5 years ago. And among the conclusions were that we had had a faster increase in new businesses from Israel than in the average business creation rate here in the Commonwealth, which is already pretty high, that the trade between us has increased by hundreds of millions of dollars, and there are jobs associated with that. And one of those companies we met there, just as an example, a company called Desalitech. We met there on that trade mission. They decided as a result of that trade mission to come here and establish their U.S. headquarters in Boston. They traveled with us to Japan on a trade mission and did a deal in Japan out of their Boston office. And they are going with us to Panama and Mexico as well for the same reasons. This matters. And we're getting great uptake. And what is, I think, in the more intangible space, people around the world, commercial interests around the world, are appreciating that that Massachusetts is a global economic player, and that's good for us.
Governor, it's good to see you.
Thank
you. We'll see you in April.
Great to be with you.
Happy March. Winter will be over by then, by the way. I don't know if you're aware.
From your lips to God's ears.
And by the way, as we say every month, every email or tweet that we receive that we didn't get to will be forwarded to the governor's office.
We didn't get to a lot. I have to apologize for that. I'm sorry. Anyway, Governor Deval Patrick joins us every month for Ask the Governor. And again, Governor Patrick, thank you.
Great to be with
you. For being with us. Up next, we're asking you about online gaming. We just asked the governor, and now we'll ask you. Is it time for Massachusetts to tap into this virtual pot of gold? You can do it in your pajamas from the couch as well. That's next on 89.7 WGBH.
I didn't know that was an option for me.
That's right. You just never know where this could lead. That's up next on Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Now, originally, I'm Jim Brown and she's Marg Regan. I was originally going to say that Gaming Commission Chairman Stephen Crosby said, quote, "The time is now. It's upon us. We can't wait any longer, even though we're still in the middle of casino licensing." And that is what he is reported to have said in the Boston Herald about online gambling. And apparently, you heard the governor say, not apparently, the governor said that from his conversations with Steve Crosby afterwards, that was exactly the opposite of Steve Crosby's position. Actually, you know, if our colleagues can call the Gaming Commission while we're here, we can find out what the deal is with that. But I can say to you, Treasurer and gubernatorial candidate Steve Grossman, I know this for a fact, is in favor of exploring online gaming. Three states have it, and a 2012 report, a task force Grossman convened, said, quote, "If the lottery does not enter this online market, other entrants, including commercial casinos, tribal casinos, commercial gaming companies, and others, will." So we want to know, regardless of where Steve Crosby himself is, where are you on the notion of online gaming? As Marjorie said jokingly, but it's not a joke at all, she just said to the governor, you can be sitting, you don't have to go to the 7-Eleven to stand in line for the lottery ticket. You don't have to go to the casino when it's built, wherever the three of them are built, or the slots parlor in Plainville. You can be sitting in your PJs or less
exactly.
on the couch in your house and gambling. And we want to know whether Crosby is for it or not. A number of significant people are. And by the way, in that same article, a soon-to-be very powerful person, soon-to-be the Senate president, Stan Rosenberg from Amherst, says, personally, I don't see how you avoid it. So apparently there are a lot of major brokers in this government, the governor not being one, obviously, from what you heard him say, who support this. And we want to know, particularly if you're a casino advocate and if you love the lottery, should we add another tier of gambling to this state, namely online gaming, as they say? 877-301-8970. I'm sorry, Marjorie.
No, I was just going to say, you know, I'm not a gambler, but I had a foot problem. I had an operation about a year ago, and I was home. You know, you have your foot up, you can't really do anything. And I spent an awful lot of time shopping online, you know, and you can just see.
No, it's addictive. It's a
you
problem.
Can just see where if you are inclined to gamble and you've got your little Visa card there and you've got a couple of hours to kill, you could get in big trouble really, really fast. I mean, at least as it is now, you got to get down to the corner store or you got to go to the casino or you got to go somewhere. I was over at Suffolk Downs a couple of weeks ago, right before the vote in Revere, and there were so many retirees that were in there doing the playing the betting the horses at the little TV screens mm-hmm. there. You know, you could just see, well, if you could do this all this online, you wouldn't have to go to Suffolk Downs. You could just hang out at home. I mean, I guess you'd miss the camaraderie of your fellow retirees that are all gambling together. But can you imagine how fast you could be in terrible financial shape?
Oh, can I imagine? Yes. The question is 877-301-8970. Let me be as middle of the road as I can be. Maybe the worst idea I have ever heard. As Marjorie said, you know, it's one thing. I'm not a huge casino fan. Actually, the CEO of Mohegan Sun, Mitchell Ettis, is going to be joining us in studio next week. And obviously, that is the casino that is bidding out of Revere that won the vote a couple of weeks ago. But, you know, Marjorie makes a very good point, is even if you're not crazy about any of this gambling stuff, if you have to get up, get dressed, go out of your way to go to the 7-Eleven or the you know, the 24-hour store, the convenience store, or you have to venture to a casino or a slots parlor, at least take some energy. The notion, you know what one of the most frightening experiences I ever had was with you, actually.
Oh, you're going to tell
about 15 years ago, Marjorie and I drove to, what's the name of that joint?
It was our version of investigative
reporting.
What was it? It was rather half-baked.
What was the name of the place?
It was
I know. Not our trip to
Magoni's?
We went to this Italian joint somewhere near Marjorie's hometown.
It's in Somerset, Rhode Island, Magoni's restaurant.
It's an Italian restaurant.
Don't criticize this restaurant. My family spends half its events at this restaurant.
No, as I've said before, if you like Chef Boyardee, you love this restaurant. That's not even an issue. I'm not going to criticize it, of course.
Chef Boyardee.
No, it's good. It's not in the can, though.
To me, you finished your plate.
But let me just say, on every table, including the table we sat at, was a keno, a game. And by the way, my recollection is in the last handful of years, several years ago, they actually, one of the things the state did is they sped up the frequency of the keno game so you can lose even more money while you're having dinner. So the reason I had such a problem with that, because obviously I'm an anti-gambling person. I don't think that's
it. Takes up a lot of space on the table.
It's one thing, again, as Marjorie said, if you have to go somewhere, but when it comes to you, whether it comes to your computer screen in your office or house or to your dinner table at Magoo's in Somerset. What's the name of it?
Magoni's.
I'm sorry. In Somerset.
It's a legend.
It really, it becomes, in my opinion, so intrusive and so dangerous, it's ridiculous. So our number is 877-301-8970. At least the future Senate president and the treasurer who would like to be governor, Steve Grossman, support this. We want to know if you do.
But we should point out that the treasurer, Steve Grossman, is opposed to using credit cards to do it. So you'd have to find a different way to do it. You couldn't be sitting home with your Visa or your MasterCard.
Yeah, but you go buy a money card somewhere with X amount of dollars. It makes it, in Steve Grossman's defense, it's a little less easy.
I think it's much less easy.
Yeah, but it's still, the reality is, if you do that, if you're somewhere else gambling and then you buy one of these cards, then you sit home and do this. It is just, the point is that the availability of 24-hour gambling opportunities, in my estimation, is not only a huge cultural shift for a state that didn't have any of this except for the lottery
right.
until the governor was here, signed the casino bill several years ago. But now, if this were to happen, essentially every place you are, your office, you could do it in your car,
you know,
on your
else?
Phone, anywhere.
You know when they have the big Powerball that gets really up high?
I always buy tickets.
Yes, but one of the reasons you might not buy a ticket is because you have to stand in line for
Correct.
So long to get there. I mean, this obviously would eliminate that problem as well. You wouldn't have to find a place to park. You wouldn't
if the lottery was online, that's
yes,
true.
Exactly. 877-301-8970. Are you anxious? Are you looking forward to the opportunity to sit on your couch in your pajamas with your Visa and MasterCard and gamble like crazy? Or do you think that this is a recipe for a disaster? Let's start with Joe in New Hampshire. What do you think, Joe?
Hi, Joe.
Good afternoon, guys. How you doing?
We're
fine,
excellent.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Great. Well, you know, I think the number one is that it already exists. I mean, if you want to go online and gamble, you can. There are plenty of sites out there. I play poker. I mean, I don't go on the gambling sites. I go on the other sites. I play, you know, fairly often. You know, and then on occasion, I will slap down a 20 on a different site and see how I do. So it's not that this is all new and Massachusetts is just going to come out and do it. Because what ended up happening is in New Hampshire, about 2 years ago, they allowed you on some certain sites to play, but then the government got involved and they took those sites down. But you can still go on to different sites. There are still sites out there that you can go on and gamble. So this isn't a new concept. I think you can get into trouble anywhere you go, no matter what you do. It's just a matter of, I enjoy it. I mean, I think I might set aside $20 a month and say, okay, I'm going to play for that.
Yeah, well, that's nothing.
Gone, it's gone. You know what I mean? Right.
Yeah, but Joe, let me tell you something. Let me make a ridiculous point. If the statute allowing for online gambling said nobody can bet more than Joe from New Hampshire bets in a month, and it's limited to $20, my attitude would be, then let people do whatever they want to do. But that's not what happens. There is a real, in light of the fact that even the proponents of casinos in our state, Joe, acknowledge that addiction is an issue and they've put money aside for it, that's when you actually go to the casino. Imagine, Joe, if they're not as self-controlled as you are, and people are sitting in their house, they can't figure out where they're going to get their rent check, so maybe I'll do one or two more games online. You can see the potential danger, right?
Yes, no, there's no question about it. I could see that. You know, you're right. You know, you are right in a way because you said, well, it's just an additional thing to put out there for a person who doesn't have the control. And you're right, they could get into some real big trouble.
Yeah. But you know, Joe, but the other side, I had Don Berwick on last night, who's anti-casino. He's running for governor. And one of the questions I asked him is, if you're against casinos and you're against online gambling, which he says he is, then you should be for abolition of the lottery, too. And his position is, well, the lottery's in place, it's too hard to get rid of, it's $1 billion of cities and towns. I would argue, if I was on your side, Joe, the train left the station. I've now said that 3 days in a row on different topics. When you have the most successful lottery in America, in Massachusetts, then people are gambling already. What's the difference? And I guess my view is, and I think Marjorie's, is this is literally and figuratively a little too close to home. But Joe, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
I think I've bought things online I would never buy in person. The only thing that stops
That's a very good point, actually.
From Amazon, particularly books and things like that, because you can get them instantaneously. And how about things you can download to your iPad? I mean, have you not done some, what do you call that buying when you do the buying instantaneously?
Instantaneous
impulse buying. It's something like that.
Well, okay, also, you know what I'm thinking, as preposterous as this is, when was the last time you bought a scratch ticket? You ever bought a scratch ticket?
I think I probably bought
them. Or a lottery ticket. I usually buy them
I don't buy them very much.
Okay, if it turned out in the lobby of WGBH, which we enter 5 days a week, if there was a lottery machine in the corner of the lobby, and before you walk through the glass doors, it said the jackpot tonight is $300 million.
Oh, absolutely.
You'd buy a ticket,
absolutely,
wouldn't you? So, I mean, imagine that, and that multiply that by 1,000, and that's what it would be like, as Marjorie says, sitting on the couch in your PJs.
Dan from Worcester. What do you think, Dan?
Hey, Dan.
Hi, Marjorie and Jim.
Hi.
You know, that restaurant you were talking about, they've added one thing to that now. They have a deck of cards on every table, and they just cut the deck with the waiter or waitress for a double or nothing, you know?
Spaghetti's. They have great cinnamon rolls in addition to spaghetti and meatballs.
That's good, Dan.
I'm going to give that place a try.
Okay.
Anyway, as far as this gambling thing is concerned, people are going to be self-destructive. Jim, I know that, or even you, Marge, might be interested, you know, want to have legalized pot in Massachusetts someday, like they're doing in Colorado.
Right.
Well, now they're finding that the people have gone wild with it out there. People are self-destructive and they're addictive. And you can't legislate it away from them. Like you said, Jim, once this door has been opened, the horse got out, it's out there, it's going to happen, and people are going to do this. And there's really not a heck of a lot you can do
well,
about
Dan,
it.
Well, Dan, let me correct you in one fashion. Mostly I agree with you, but Marjorie cited a statistic yesterday that is borne out. No one, I don't know anybody, even regardless of their position, disagrees. If you're within 50 miles of a casino, the research shows the likelihood of addiction jumps dramatically. So forget 50 miles. What if you're 50 inches away from your computer screen? You would agree that that makes it much more likely for a problem gambler to get into trouble, no?
I would agree with that, absolutely. And I have one question about that. How
sure.
do you pay for that? What do you have, a credit card or something?
Yes.
You can't buy lottery tickets with a credit card in Massachusetts.
No, but one of the things that Grossman, who supports at least the experimentation with this, the treasurer, as Marjorie said before, is essentially a cash card. Obviously, it's not the law yet. You'd go to a casino, you'd go to your 7-Eleven, you'd go to somewhere and buy a card. Maybe they'd put a limit on a $50 card, and then you'd enter the code number from that card up till you use all your money on the computer screen. Again, this is in the abstract. It only exists in three straight states. I think it's Nevada, New Jersey, and I can't think of what. Delaware is the third state right now. So that's the theory. Dan, thanks for the call. As always, we appreciate it.
Bree from Wellesley. What do you think, Bree?
Hey, Bree.
I think it's a horrible idea.
Good.
Okay. Do you want to elaborate on that a little, Bree?
No. Well, I'm a physician, and I think so. I come across the things that affect my patients every day: obesity, not having jobs, not being able to pay for health care, all of those things. I don't see where online gambling is going to contribute in any way. I see that we'll get some taxes from it, but I think that we'll end up paying them out in, for lack of a better word, although I hate the word, entitlement.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think it's the idea of the ease. It just makes it so easy, and that to me is really the scary part. Bree, thank you very much for the call. Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Our email is wgbhnews.org. There's a possibility of online gambling. The gentleman that called from New Hampshire, I don't really know, actually, if those same sites are available in Massachusetts, but we're talking about a significant increase of online gambling, and it's become an issue in the gubernatorial race. Martha Coakley is very much against it. Steve Grossman, who's running, likes it, but he doesn't want to have basically the reason he likes it is he's worried about competition for the lottery. Mm-hmm. And he thinks, but he thinks that credit cards should not be used. Charlie Baker, who's running on the Republican side, he doesn't like online gambling either. Heather from Framingham, what do you think?
Hi, Heather.
Hi. I'm actually for it. I'm not a gambler myself, but, horse racing, you can already do gambling online. There are websites for that. My husband and my father use them.
Let me ask you a quick question, Heather, about that. So why is it that everybody goes, well, not everybody, but all these people go to Suffolk Downs to do the horse racing there just for company? Because the place is packed with people doing the horse racing.
Why do people go to a baseball game instead of sitting on their couch
and
watching
it?
No, but I'm saying because it's the experience, yeah. Right?
Absolutely. I mean, that's what my father does. He has a racetrack where he lives locally, and he will go to that when he wants to. And he also will put, $20 on at a time online and play with that with the horses as well. And, I do not see him abusing it, and I don't see my husband abusing it either. There are times they want to go be social, and there are times they want to do it at their house. Until a few years ago, online poker was legal in the U.S. too. My husband is a poker player, which he considers a game of skill, not gambling, and he plays online still. But he has to go to the gas station and get, a $25 Visa card or whatever, and put that online through an international site. No, it's not legal. But is it available in the United States? Yes.
Yeah.
Heather, thank you for the call. We appreciate it.
I must admit here, I'm arguing against myself because I have argued when we're making legislation about liquor or marijuana that we shouldn't operate from the assumption that everybody's going to get addicted. And here I guess I'm changing my tune because I am operating from the assumption that people are going to
become
more addicted.
Well, it's not just addiction. There's a secondary impact. What impact the gambling has on all the rest of us. By the way, just for clarification, you heard the governor say that Steve Crosby was not saying what it appeared he was saying. He was not saying, come on down. We just asked for a statement from the Gaming Commission. Here is the actual statement from Chairman Crosby, I guess correcting what he suggests was the wrong impression. It's clear that although internet gaming is a topic that gaming regulators must begin vetting, it's important to proceed, and then italics, slowly and methodically. Internet gaming remains relatively new territory. Its effects on the industry in the three states where iGaming is legalized are not yet fully known. It's best to allow time for the early adopter jurisdictions, the three states I mentioned, to test this out and study it. So obviously the enthusiasm was not quite what we suggested. Scott, you're in New Bedford. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Great. What's up?
I just wanted to say that if the state was or somebody was against gambling, internet gambling, there's already internet gambling. Why doesn't the state just train people how to trade in the stock market, and then people have actually a better chance of making their money back, as opposed to going to these big companies that whose whole purpose is to get you to give them their money with very little chance of getting it back?
Now, you ask, I know you have a little piece of your tongue in cheek, but an interesting question is, why doesn't that satisfy the urge of gamblers? Why is, quote, betting, I don't think that's the verb that people in the stock market would use, why is betting on the stock market considered any different than, because Because theoretically, what there's more there you can study the facts as opposed to games of chance, but you can study odds and those sort of things.
But I know a lot of horse bettors, people that bet on the horses, think that they're really, really good handicappers, and they think that there's a real skill involved in that. So, but that's a great question.
Scott, it's a great point.
Art just emailed. He had a wonderful point, too.
What's his point?
Well, there are some benefits to this. And one of the big ones is no more piles of all those losing scratch tickets all over the parking lots and the convenience stores. You know, they are sort of a trash hazard. Okay, enough of that. Up next, we're going to be joined by Alex Beam for Open Mic. His take on a riches-to-rags scenario. This is an unbelievable story. And more dispatches from his pew hopping. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And joining us, as he does every Thursday, is Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam. And as Marjorie and I do every Thursday when Alex comes on, you know this to be true, Alex, we marvel at how the universe conspired to give Alex Beam the perfect name because, like a laser beam, Marjorie said this, he always is right on point and drives cats crazy. It's just this. Now, Alex, hi, Alex. Before
they don't
we start,
shine me in the eyes of pilots trying to land at Logan.
Okay, Alex, yeah, before we get started, you were whining the last couple of weeks that you had not, I think it was during Pledge Week, that you wanted a WGBH Echo bag and we didn't have one available.
That's exactly right.
We actually now have, it's sort of a mock up. We have one for you here. And
is this a real?
It's not.
I can't even stand the air.
It's a little denim thing, and we hand wrote WGBH on it. But it's yours to keep and
this
do whatever you want
genuine.
With.
Genuine.
I think it's quite nice.
Oh, really?
That's not the Echo bag, is it?
I printed the WGBH right on it. What do you mean it's not? Of course.
If only we were on your vaunted television show, nobody would
much.
See
okay,
this. Fine. Okay, sorry. Just a joke. Yeah.
Okay. So let's you gave us to read this very moving story about this woman that started. Why are you making faces?
I can't associate myself with a moving
about
story.
This church that this woman started on the Boston Common for homeless people. You did. That was one of the things. You're looking at me like I'm out of my mind.
No, I sent you a link to the Cathedral on the Common website. Which
tell
was,
people about this.
Well, it's this kind of astonishing thing that has exploded. I kind of analogize it to First Night. It started in Boston. A woman I've spoken with only by telephone. Named the Reverend Deborah Little, knew that some homeless people congregated at the Cathedral of St. Paul's, which is the Episcopal Cathedral on the Boston Common. And Easter, in either 1994 or 1996, I can't quite remember straight, she decided to have sort of Easter Mass on the Common for the homeless, not for anyone else. It's not extraordinary to have church outside, if you will. It's like having class outside.
Right.
But she had church outside for the homeless, like they were to participate. And to get way ahead of the story, astonishingly, she no longer does that for a living. For a living, she curates a website, Little Ministries, something or other, and 250 churches around the world now have such church services specifically for a homeless congregation. And it's a spiritual ministry to the homeless. And then just to get ahead, my next column, which you guys are generous enough to talk about when I come in here, but my next column, which will appear on Saturday, is about a church that spun off from Deborah Little's original ministry, which is called the Outdoor Church of Cambridge. And
Where is it in Cambridge?
I just have to laugh because the last three Sundays I've been at the Porter Square Tea Stop.
Is that where she does this?
This is Jedediah Manis and Tom Hathaway.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, sorry. This is a spinoff, if you will.
I understand that.
Okay. And the Outdoor Church of Cambridge is every Sunday. I did not go in the depth of winter. I'm a fair weather Christian if ever there was one. At 9 a.m., you can go. You'll be at the Porter Square Tea Stop, and they set up. I described it as an altar on a shopping cart. It's like a kind of little altar on rollers. They roll it up there, 9 a.m., more or less. They start a church service, and at 9 a.m., more or less, homeless people congregate to the service, whom they all know, of course, by now. The Outdoor Church in Cambridge has been going on for several years. And then they do that again on the Common at 1 p.m.
Boston Common or Cambridge Common?
Excuse me, the Cambridge Common. Yeah, because it's the outdoor church in Cambridge. And they devote, the two reverends devote Sunday to, as I my infelicitous choice of words, to wandering around Cambridge, making contact with homeless people and giving them sandwiches, which are often made by youth groups at other churches. And in the winter, they give them socks. Now, even though you didn't ask, the reason I wrote about this was because I became very deeply intrigued with Reverend Manus and a long conversation we had about what they were doing. And virtually one of the first things he said to me is, we are a church, not a social welfare agency. Another thing he said to me during that conversation is, you know, we don't get a lot of big foundation support because we don't have a path out of homeless. All these kind of cliches that you hear, we are delivering, if you will, spiritual food to the homeless. And that kind of got my attention because it was a little counterintuitive for me as a bourgeois newspaper reader. Oh, the homelessness is a pathology. We've got to cure these people. It's almost as if every homeless person is a potential undergraduate at Wesleyan College. And I was sort of learning something different. And I know dangerously little now.
For example, this thing at the Porter Tea Stop, do roughly the same group of homeless people come every Sunday? I mean, this is like appointment service time for them?
I would cautiously answer that yes, because I've only been three times. It's a small group. And as I also sort of sardonically noted in my column coming out on Saturday, I've been going to suburban churches and like coffee hour is a big deal for the homeless. You know, suburbanites love coffee hour. You know,
right.
They get together and they talk about like who got a B+ in the high school test. Well, I did kind of notice that at 9 a.m., like the reverends are present, a few homeless people are present, a few visitors like myself are present. But at 9:40 a.m., when the Dunkin' Donuts gallon of Joe comes out and Jed Manus has this great carton of donuts, suddenly there's a lot more homeless present. I say that in the spirit of religiousness. But they know these people, they keep tabs on them. And I want to make one other point that just so that I for context, when I say I was genuinely intrigued with this idea of worshiping out of doors, sort of naked. You know, you're in Porter Square. Everyone's staring at you. I finally realized, like, a church is like a fortress. Like, those walls are there for a reason, so you can do this in private. But in the middle of Porter Square, there's nothing private. It's just you, and you're at church. And I mean, it's very. I found it very open, very stark, very naked, very fulfilling for me personally. Now, where was I? I've totally lost.
This is like
track.
A Proustian yeah. sentence. You've been talking. I mean, this, even though it's a very interesting story,
story. One of the things I can't help but think is this winter obviously has been freezing and snow. And so this is going on when it's 12 or 15 degrees in a foot of snow.
Yeah, I did finally, as it were, catch up to the caboose of my train of thought. Yes. And Manus was hoping that the Boston Globe would do a different kind of story because some of the homeless people have children. And another thing, again,
What do you mean?
Different kind of story, how?
Well, in that the sheltering isn't 100% perfect. It's pretty darned good, especially in Cambridge, which was the point I wanted to make for context, because I'm talking about how these people deliver religion to the homeless. I mean, to be fair, Cambridge and Massachusetts generally, you know, it's an extremely generous community for social services for the homeless. There are, you know, three shelters within, shall we say, tea distance. These congregants seem to generally spend the night either at the Pine Street Inn or at 240 Albany Street, or, wait for it, an extraordinary so-called dry shelter run by Harvard students at the University Lutheran Church in Harvard Square. Arguably, I gather, sort of the best run and best ministered shelter, but it's a dry shelter. And it's even just the very few conversations I've had with homeless people, a lot of them don't want to go to a dry shelter.
Meaning you have to be in recovery?
No, meaning...
Just can't drink.
Yeah.
You
can't look drunk, you can't look high, and you can't drink or do drugs on the premises.
Okay.
And it's odd because there's almost like an honor system, you know. I did talk to some people. I said, well, why don't you go over there? Because the Harvard kids, man, they got quite a setup. I just can't. I'm not dry.
You know, staying really on the same subject about people down on their luck, I don't know if we should call this art it could be you segment, but I think it you know, I think
this is a stop complaining. There for the grace of God go I segment.
You also alerted us to a story that is eye opening to say the least about somebody who you think you may have worked with in a earlier life.
I know I worked with Joe Williams.
Joe Williams, former editor at the Globe.
Former editor at the Boston Globe, former reporter, editor, and deputy Washington bureau chief for the Boston Globe. Definitely was the living editor. I mean, there was this. First of all, he's written this astonishing article on the Atlantic Magazine website, so he's obviously a gifted writer and storyteller. He did cruise around the globe as an editor, which in a way I'm thinking might not have been his actual calling. But the thrust of this, I mean, I'm happy to summarize it.
Please do.
This guy is indeed exactly like us. He's the deputy bureau chief of a reputable newspaper in Washington. He goes to Politico. Not only is he a good political reporter, he's on TV all the time. In other words, as he himself says, his career is very much on an upward trajectory when suddenly, for two reasons, if not three, he loses his job at Politico. He commits what Michael Kinsley used to call a gaffe. And when Kinsley talks about a gaffe, it means he told the truth and thus was vilified for it. You know, he made this kind of offhand comment that even I, as really a Mitt Romney supporter, don't find the least bit offensive. He said, I guess, on MSNBC, Joe Williams said, well, I'm paraphrasing, it's just basically pretty obvious that Mitt Romney's less comfortable in a sort of diverse town hall setting and more comfortable when he's on Fox and Friends with his white pals.
Quote, they're white folks who are very much relaxed in their own company, is his exact quote.
Right, and what could be more true? I'm a pro-Romney guy. Romney is the whitest American on earth.
Well, Joe Williams is also an African American. He thought that played into part of why he was vilified.
Yes. I mean, and then again, a separate discussion we're not having right now, but this, the internet outrage machine.
Yes.
Which went ballistic. I often use the term lynch mob. I know it's not appropriate, but it's nuts. It's effectively unseated him.
But we should say, in all fairness, it unseated him after Andrew Breitbart, who obviously is now dead. Andrew Breitbart, after this, he had seen this on MSNBC. Found on Williams' Twitter account what even Williams acknowledged was a crude Romney joke.
Can you paraphrase that?
The joke is not.
Because I don't know what the joke is.
The joke is not there. He just characterizes himself as a crude Romney joke. And then a little more searching is done. And
this is the bad part.
And it turned out that there's a headline on something called Fishbowl DC, who obtained court documents that said ex-Politico White House correspondent Joe Williams pled guilty to assaulting ex-wife, and at least Williams' explanation is that he had completed 6 months of probation. He had signed a court order to stay away from his wife, so he had been involved in something. But the story is not so much about his fall from grace almost overnight at age 50. The story is, after that, he can't get a job anywhere. He gets a job at an unnamed sporting goods place as a retail worker, as a clerk. And this piece he writes, which I thought was fabulous for The Atlantic, and it's called My Life as a Retail Worker, Nasty, Brutish, and Poor, if you want to check it out, is about life as a retail worker. Sum that experience up, Alex Beam.
Well, it's just a place none of us wants to go. And the fact that someone exactly analogous to us in education and competency, he's at Marathon Sports or something, but I assume this is a complete recapitulation of a book I never read, Barbara Ehrenreich's book, Nickel and Dime.
Yeah.
But Joe makes crystal clear with this just painful writing that, you know, a $10 a week job at the
$10 an hour job.
$10 an hour job at the near bottom of the American economy. And we're now talking about millions of jobs. We know that Obama talked about this very subject just yesterday. But all these Walmart jobs, I just had lunch at McDonald's, unbelievably, and a guy is cleaning up and the manager comes over and says, Jose, put this cap on. So Jose has to put on a cap for the bacon double cheeseburger. In other words, they use these people as signage, among other things. But
what did you eat at McDonald's?
The salad. But Joe, okay. Joe Williams,
he did not have a
salad. I mean,
salad,
the things that are happening are just very difficult to swallow. He has to agree to be searched, what they call shrinkage, they're obsessed with stealing.
Yeah.
So he has to agree to be searched if he goes to get a frap across the street.
If he wears a hoodie or a big jacket to work, Stretch, his boss, his supervisor, says, we'll have to pat you down.
Yeah.
It is the most dehumanizing
And staying after 3, hours, too, after a shift to clean
and
the
not getting paid
vacuum,
for it, by the
clean
way.
The toilets, clean the bathroom, empty the garbage.
I couldn't agree with you more. Which the hours add up, and then it's like apparently a boy-girl thing he describes that only the men can haul the trash out to the dumpster, which is surveilled by a camera. So they don't even trust their own people to throw away the trash because they think they might be stealing from the trash. But it's done in twos. In other words, one person goes out to monitor Joe, who's emptying the trash. You're exactly right. I mean, at both ends of the day, it's all free time. You have to get there early. That's free time. You have to stay late. That's free time. And, of course, the other detail that I'm sure none of us missed is that they keep hammering down his hours, and he kind of doesn't get it. He's a little naive. And, of course, they want to make sure that he doesn't trip the 35-hour a week.
So he gets benefits. Like, you know, before we leave this topic, though, the point of this piece, I'm quite sure, is he wants to say, well, much of the world, and including the majority of Americans, are supporting the president's effort to raise the minimum wage. We just discussed it in-state with Deval Patrick. You should also, and he hopes they do, I'm sure, he also says you should know what life is like for minimum wage workers, which is a whole other kind of thing. Alex, last thing for you. And Marjorie and I were having a debate this morning as to whether or not to even touch this, because she says it's too complex. I said, here's what we're going to do.
I hope it's math.
We're going to say to Alex, you have 45 seconds, which during which we will not interrupt you, during which time you have to describe to the listeners what the controversy about Herbalife and Ed Markey is. And here's what I'm going to do.
45 seconds.
I'm going to time
like
you. You have 3 seconds to think about, and then we'll start. So listen carefully. It's a big issue. 2, 1. Go.
Okay. What the listeners need to know is that many high-profile public policy issues of the last decade that you actually think are about this policy versus that policy. For instance, the jihad against for-profit education. You think, oh, well, that was legitimate. They were taking money out of veterans' pockets. BS. It was all driven by short sellers. What I'm telling you is a lot of these stories that you read in the news are actually driven by Wall Street manipulators who are seeking to drive down the publicly traded stocks of companies. In the example of the bogus investigations into the for-profit education, Kaplan, which was owned by the Washington Post, was driven way, way down. Right now, Ed Markey is caught hilariously, been gulled. By the way, you notice Elizabeth Warren was too smart to get caught in this. You know, Ed Markey is fronting for Bill Ackman, this essentially, well, I don't know. I'm not going to use any bad words, but he's just a short seller. He's just a guy. He doesn't care about the Hispanics or getting cheated by Herbalife. Believe me, nothing means less to Bill Ackman. And now Ed Markey is like mired because he's writing letters on this guy's behalf, trying to interfere with the Federal Trade Commission, blah, blah, blah.
Because if Herbalife,
the subhead read that he made a $1 billion bet that this Herbalife would fail, and then he lobbied to make sure it would fail, you know, with his influential connections in Congress.
Congress people, state legislators, asking, say, call for investigation.
Yeah, Tito Jackson, for those of you following at home. Larry Raske, for those of you following. Let's get the names out there. They should be very proud of their nefarious role. You know, as ludicrous front people and puppets for a Wall Street billionaire, Bill Ackman, who has a nice house on the Cape, I'm told.
He does?
I believe he
does. Where on the Cape?
No comment.
Okay.
Where on the Cape?
It's like Truro area, I believe.
Really? Truro area, okay.
Yeah, believe me, we're not getting out there because there's a fence.
That took you a minute and 20 seconds.
Wow.
You know what the most significant thing you just said here?
Is it upsetting? I mean, people need to know. People need to have their eyes open. That's all.
No, the most important point you made was the point you made, which is often it has nothing to do with the substance of a public dispute about whether a company is meritorious or not meritorious.
Well, that's right. You don't know.
It's their betting.
Should you take Herbalife or should not take
Herbalife?
Well, Herbalife
is, I mean, it's a fat target. There's several other, the for-profit thing really bugged me because a young friend of mine at like some big foundation was testifying before Congress. And to me, they're just cat's paws for Wall Street manipulators. Mine is a very dark, by the way, very dark and extreme view. Just FYI, if you own stock in robot surgery companies, boop, it's too late because they've been massively shorted. And they've, you know, what you do is you have to leak all these like stories to Wall Street Journal reporters. That's the absolute best case scenario where they go, oh, robot surgery, not as good as you thought. Google Wall Street short sellers and robot surgery. You'll see what I mean. In other words, that's another whole sector that they've decided to collapse. Again, they've chosen well. Robot surgery is semi-bogus, although there's a lot of money been invested in
it. What we would like you to do is to tweet us at BOS Public Radio to tell us if you have any idea what Alex is talking about. And when he, I'm serious. And when he is back next Thursday, then it'll be an experiment for us. If a story of some complication can be told by Alex Beam each Thursday, it could be a regular feature in what was a minute and 20 seconds. Let the listeners
but
decide.
Is that fair to like limit me to such a
no,
why don't you let me like
fair.
Hold forth and
no,
like, but if I'll go through my talking points.
Well, if you get past the initial threshold in the minute and 20 seconds, then we'll maybe give you a
so
chance.
So you gave me a B plus, right?
It was quite, it was actually excellent. Pretty good. It okay. was quite
but
good.
But we still thank don't you. Know, should you buy Herbalife or should you not buy Herbalife? That's
well,
the
first of all, you shouldn't
question.
Take Herbalife. Okay. okay. The dubious supplements. Second of all, you shouldn't become a franchisee because you'll never make any money. And third of all, if you have stock in Herbalife, now that's a very complicated question because Carl Icahn's on the other side of this bet. I would just be very, very careful. So,
now,
I mean,
Alex, yeah, before yes. you go, when you leave, you know we're
thanks
doing?
Thanks for the eco bag, by
You're
the
welcome.
Way. Yeah,
before
okay.
you leave, you know we're doing? We are celebrating in a few minutes with our listeners the 25th anniversary of the World Wide Web. How are you celebrating today?
I am turning off all my internet connections.
You're going dark?
I'm going totally dark. It's the only time I'm happy.
That is beautiful.
I'll be like the Malaysia Airlines plane. Oh, that's a terrible
that
analogy.
That is really
sorry.
Low rent.
Charlie well, Pierce once got thrown off public radio for a similar
Fine,
analogy.
Well,
I'll tell you when
the
we're
same
off here.
Thing. Thank you very
yeah,
much.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Okay. Hey, Alex, it was great to see you. Enjoy the bag.
Alex
yeah, take care.
Beam is a columnist
By the way, it is a bag and it says
Yeah, but it's not a real eco bag. I've been screwed.
Yeah, he's a man Maybe. Of great secrecy. He's written many books, but
Enjoy
he
it.
Doesn't want to know, want the public to know what those books are, at least at this possible moment. Up next is Jim Justo. We are asking about the internet. Turns 25 this week. How has it changed your life? Up next on 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Brody. She is Marjorie. And the internet, or as it was known in its infancy, do you remember this? The World Wide Web turns 25 this week. And we want to know at 877-301-8970 how it's changed your life. Has it expanded your universe or has it turned you into a recluse? Is the world better or worse? This is your opportunity to pay your birthday respects to the internet or your birthday disses at 877-301-8970. I also want to set chronological thresholds. For those of you who are, let's say 35 and over, do you remember life without it? And for those of you who are, let's say, under 35, can you imagine life without it? You know, in the front hall of my house, you know what I have Encyclopedia
what?
Britannica's from like 20 years ago.
You now, do?
On the, I mean, I intended years ago to give them away when they were still of some value. Do you remember 20 years ago?
I do.
If you had to look something up, what you had to do? You had to go to the library.
Encyclopedia Britannica.
You flip through the Encyclopedia
yes.
Britannica. You felt really privileged, and you hope you could figure out what it is you were looking for. Now, if someone, again, is under 35 and is listening, they will probably have no comprehension of what that is like. All you do is you essentially type something in and click. It is not so long ago that this did not exist. 25 years ago. We read this morning. Do you know how many emails Bill Clinton sent? And he's a pretty tech-savvy guy in his whole presidency.
Almost none.
Two. He sent two emails in his whole presidency, which makes you realize how fast, how far this has come this fast. And by the way, while there are all these debates about net neutrality and is it going to be free and open in so many respects, we're going to leave that for another day. We want to know today where you are, what it's meant to you, and can you imagine life without it? And can you remember, if you're a little bit older, life without it at 877-301-8970?
One of the great stories they talked about in the research we read was that when the Obama administration came into the White House, and of course they were famous for using social media and their web savvy and all the young tech geniuses they had working on the campaign to win the election for them in 2008. They came into the White House, and the White House was practically unplugged. You know, Bush, the White House there was just not equipped with any of this stuff. And I think it was actually a room with a typewriter in it and the pieces left over from an IBM computer. And there's this great little memo.
Oh, is this the Hillary Clinton?
To Hillary Clinton.
I love this
yeah,
thing.
This is a Clinton White House memo in 1995. Quote,
Lisa Caputo, is that who sent it
that's
to her?
That's right.
Who's her communications person or someone?
That
so
is
someone
correct.
Who
her
arguably
press
is pretty savvy in that
yeah.
world.
That, quote, Hillary could speak to young women through internet.
Not the internet.
Not the internet, just internet. Internet has become a very popular mode of communication. I mean, it's just hysterical. So, you know, but you can see how
obviously, people are totally wired all the time, and I don't think it's a good thing in the long run. The research will be coming in pretty soon, Jim, that we've lost our ability to think.
Well, maybe we've lost our ability to think, but it is a fabulous thing. So, Marjorie, not that we've lost our ability to think. If you had to give up, what's the one technological thing in your life that you would not give up? You can think you can go from your phone.
It's your phone, absolutely. Yeah. I'm very fond of my iPad as well. That'd be tough.
You don't think internet access would be number one? I know that people use their phone.
Oh, well, that's what I mean.
I'm talking about separate those things.
Oh, okay.
Ability to use the internet. You couldn't do your job.
I could not do my job.
You couldn't go shopping. You name whatever it is. You couldn't check out your friends from college to see if they've been successful or they're in jail. I mean, I'm serious.
A million years ago when I was a young reporter, I remember I was all excited. I got to write a story. I was then a stringer for the Globe. And I got to write a story about Cape Cod in the summertime. Mm-hmm. And what you used to do is it was a long feature. You roll it out on the floor, and you cut and paste and rearrange paragraphs. I mean, that's what you did.
How about research? You know what I used to do?
You'd have to go look everything
up. The main
up.
Branch of the Boston
Library.
Public Library.
Yeah.
I would go into the microfilm division. They had these incredible machines. You had to find the little cassette. This is 20,
yeah.
maybe 22 years ago. It's not 122 years ago. So we're celebrating the 25th anniversary with you for the next few minutes at 877-301-8970. You happy? You sad? You're with Marjorie. Thinks it's what do you think it turned us into? You think it's a bad thing? Is that what
I think the early research that says we have very difficult time, that the kids that are brought up on the internet and brought up with the cell phones and the texting, and it's very difficult for them to concentrate for a long period of time, to focus for a long period of time.
They can't relate to other people.
And they get distracted all the time, that they can't, you know, that you need those long periods of focused attention where you start to lose your brain cells or something like that.
Something like that. Mary, you're in East Greenwich, Rhode Island. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Thank you much for the call.
I'm thrilled. I finally got through. I listen to both of you every time I'm on my way back from Connecticut teaching my chemistry class, and I never call because I just don't use the phone when I'm driving.
Oh, thank you, Mary.
And here I am at my desk grading laboratory exams my students took yesterday and listening to you on my desktop computer with my iPad next to me and saying, I'm Republican, say it's wonderful. I love the internet.
Don't go away. Let's find out. Do you think what Mary's doing is antisocial, dangerous, destructive behavior?
No, but I wonder, are you teaching college kids, high school kids?
I taught high school kids for years and years, and now in my second non-retirement, I'm teaching community college students.
So what do you think? So what do you think has been the impact on the students you see of the constant wired up deal?
I think overall, it is exactly the same. The students who years ago, like Jim alluded to it and I did, went to the library with our 3x5 index cards and did our notes and submitted our outline are the same students who will search the web and do their research and submit their information and their preliminary outline and preliminary draft, and the rest won't. It's just one analog far forward, and they have so much more at their fingertips.
They do. Hey, Mary, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Part of the instructor's role is to screen and narrow them and direct them to really good resources, not just junk. I teach chemistry. It's not really opinion. And I'll say, all right, you can look at Wikipedia just to get a general idea, but here's where I want you to go, where there are really, really good resources to supplement your chemistry that you're learning.
Hey, Mary, we're really glad you finally made the phone call, and we're glad you're listening online. Mary, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
Well, that is a good point.
What's that?
To be able to listen. I mean, I think about my obsession with House of Cards, which I was watching on my iPad in bed.
Well, also, I don't know if you know, we're on 12 to 2, even though we repeat at night. What are most people doing from 12 to 2? They're at work. Are they not?
That's an excellent
most people. So, thank you.
That's an excellent point.
Suzanne, like the first caller. Suzanne, you're in a car. You're on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about the 25th anniversary of the World Wide Web. Hey, Suzanne.
Hey, Jim. How you doing? Hey, Marjorie.
Hi, Suzanne.
Jim, it's Suzanne who you rear-ended.
Okay. This is one of the worst experiences of my life. I'm going to give the short version.
Correct. Was he texting
at the
time?
You remember this woman. I rear-ended her on Melnia Cass Boulevard. She gets out of her car. This is like a decade ago. Furious. And then all of a sudden, she sees it's me. And what do you say, Suzanne?
I say, oh, no, it's Jim Brownie.
And then, to make it worse, because I was incredibly kind, and I offered to pay for all the damage or whatever, Marjorie and I go on the radio, and our producer says in our ear, there's this woman on the phone while we're on the air who says you just rear-ended her on Melnia Cass Boulevard, and you proceeded to come on air and do what you're doing now, telling everybody what happened.
You're never going to live this down, Jeff.
No, apparently not. Suzanne, it's great to hear from you. What do you have today, Suzanne?
Thanks for taking my call. So here's what I have for you today about the internet. I am over 35, and I bought my first home in 1993 before there was widespread use of the internet. And I'm sure you guys will remember this. You'd get the Sunday Globe, right? You'd get the listings. You'd read the two little lines with all the abbreviations about 3BDRM, 1BDH, right? You'd circle it. Then you'd get your giant map out, right? And if there was an open house, because otherwise you wouldn't know the address, you'd try to figure out where it was. Then you'd get in your car and you'd try to surreptitiously do a drive-by to see what kind of a neighborhood it was in, right? And if you wanted to see the inside, you either had to show up for the open house or call a realtor. We recently purchased a house on the Cape. I probably looked at 500 houses online. Not only looked at the every single room inside the house, then went to Google Earth like a stalker and looked at the entire neighborhood where the house was located. Never crossed the Sagamore Bridge until we narrowed it down to three or four that we wanted to see, at which time I felt like I knew the entire layout of the house before I had, or without even having to leave my own den to do that.
So, hey, Suzanne, that is perfect.
I'm totally convinced. I mean, that's a great story.
Well, do you remember, since you're in the newspaper business, and I wasn't in the media business, and Suzanne, the one thing you left out is some of us said, do you have a friend who knows somebody at the Globe who can get us the real estate section on Saturday night so the houses aren't all gone on Sunday?
Do you know it?
Hey, Suzanne, it's great to hear from you. That was a great story. Thanks so much for the call.
At the old Harold Building where we used to have all the presses and all the Sunday circulars and the real estate thing, that was a very big deal. They kept them in a separate place, and lock and key is an exaggeration.
I mean, away from people so they couldn't get early
access.
Exactly.
You were not supposed to be swiping the Sunday circulars or the real estate things. Absolutely.
By the way, when Suzanne said I rear-ended, I tapped her rear bumper a little bit.
You have a history of rear-ending.
No, I do not have a history. No, I do not.
Yes, you do.
Thank you very much.
Texting people and suddenly, wham.
Colby in North Bedford, you are next on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Colby. It's not true. God.
New Bedford.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Hi, New Bedford.
Good to talk to you.
Hi. First time caller. I listen to you every single day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I remember when you had to go into the library, look everything up. And the New Bedford High School, when I was a sophomore in school, they just put in brand new personal computers. You couldn't imagine how happy everyone was. And I'm sitting there going, I have to type HTML www.google. This will never last.
Oh, we lost you, Colby. Oh, there he is.
This Google thing will never last. Now it's the biggest company in the world.
Colby, good story. Thank you so much for the call. It really is amazing.
Remember that Internet for Dummies book?
Oh, of course I do.
Yeah, it came out so we could all learn how to do it. And the sound, if you, we were talking about this, or I wasn't talking about this, but somebody else was talking about this on the radio this morning, the sound you used to get with the dial-on.
Oh, dial-up. You mean the
dial-up hookup.
Like AOL in the early days.
Yes, the noise it made when you get on. And the You've Got Mail thing from that movie with that blonde.
Tom Hanks.
Is it Meg Ryan?
Ryan.
Yeah, thank you very much, John Parker. Meg Ryan. I love that movie.
Let's squeeze one more quick one in. Nikki, you're in Chelmsford. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Nikki.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. We're short on time, though.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
How do you date the inception of the World Wide Web?
We date it by virtue of the fact that there are tons of interviews with the guy whose name is Tim Berners-Lee, who says that he, and we didn't get into our Al Gore issues, he essentially started this whole thing exactly 25 years ago this week. Why do you question that?
Yes, I do.
Why?
Because it was started by the government, and it was originally known as ARPANET. And I was an employee at Digital Equipment Corporation, and I started in 1984, and they had an EasyNet all around the world at that time. So I'm just wondering where...
Nikki, we'll do research between now and tomorrow, we'll say something tomorrow. By the way, we forgot to mention the inventor said they were considering not calling it the World Wide Web, the Mine of Information.
I know.
The Mesh, M-E-S-H. Isn't that pretty great?
The Mesh isn't bad. That could have worked.
Yeah, Chelsea, quite our well. Colleague, suggests we do the research on what Nikki just said at the library rather than online. We'll do that tonight.
Okay. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow, Emily Rooney's World Famous List and our Friday news quiz with musicians Elijah
really
Wall and
this.
Livingston Taylor. Our show is a production of WGBH. Our production team is Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, John Parker, and Amanda McGowan. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I am Jim Browning.
Thank you so much for tuning in.